From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on Friday, August 21st, in Nashua, New Hampshire. Ohio Governor John Kasich was speaking to a crowd who are considering their votes in the upcoming Republican presidential primary. Governor Kasich said, quote, "If I were not president, but if I were king of America, I would abolish all teachers' lounges, where they sit together and worry about woe is us." As you might imagine, organized labor did not take kindly to this comment. And the irony is that Kasich has been positioning himself as friendlier with labor than Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who famously battled unions in his state. Kasich says he's had to listen to the people, and he has a much stronger relationship with labor. Well, it's almost Labor Day. We like to take stock of the big issues facing labor, particularly with an election on the horizon. And let's look around our community as well for issues related to women in labor, among other things. Let's welcome our guest for the hour. Kendall Bell's here. Kendall is the president of CLUW, that's C-L-U-W, the Coalition of Labor Union Women. Kendall, nice to have you here.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Shelley Clements is here. She's a labor relations specialist with New York State United Teachers, and she's with the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, a former city school teacher as well. Shelley, nice to have you.
Thank you.
Bruce Popper's here. Bruce is president of the Rochester Labor Council and among other titles. Bruce, nice to have you back here.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
All right. Well, I want to start with that comment here. And Shelley, probably fortunately for Governor Kasich, you hadn't heard that until today.
that's the understatement.
What did you think?
It's very funny that oftentimes people who are not in classroom settings will make statements like that. Teacher workrooms are just that. They're workrooms. Teachers are dedicated to improving the working conditions and the profession as a whole. And if you were to go by any workroom, you would probably find discussions going on about pedagogy. You would probably find people trying to correct papers. You would probably find teachers collaborating about the right way to help a student to understand an issue. You might even find people laughing and just generally feeling good about the fact that there are teachers in classrooms. Woe is me. I'm not so sure you'll find a lot of that.
Does that contribute to a stereotype of the current teacher in this country?
It is unfortunate that teachers as a profession have been under the attack that they've been. The solution to the issues with our economy, the solution to what can really honestly change the world is in a classroom and is with an educational professional. And it is unfortunate that this cast has been placed on them.
Well, Bruce, as president of the Rochester Labor Council, what do you make of Governor Kasich's remarks about teachers?
Well, first of all, an attack on the teachers is really an attack on organized labor, because the union movement has shifted just like the workforce has shifted. One third of our members in the Rochester region are members of the New York State United Teachers. And that is typical across the country. One out of three union members in the United States today belongs to one of the two larger teacher unions. So we in the other unions view an attack on teachers as not only an attack on teachers, but an attack on the union movement itself, because the teachers are one of the most successful. They stand for quality education. They defend the kids. They have difficult jobs, and they don't deserve the rap they're getting from these governors and from the increasing number of Republicans that want to make them scapegoats for situations in education.
All right, listeners, if you want to weigh in, even if you disagree, if you want to challenge some of what you heard or talk about the state of American labor, you can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994 right here in Rochester. It's at Evan Dawson on Twitter. And Bruce mentions the fact that a third of union members are teachers in one form or another. And what do you make of what people think of labor? I mean, what does labor look like today in 2015 in this country, Bruce? Is it what people think of, or is that changing?
Well, we look at our membership in the Rochester area, which again is typical of the rest of the United States. The union movement is consisting of social workers, civil servants, firefighters, police, a whole variety of public sector workers, postal workers. Some people are surprised and find out that the musicians in the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra are members of a union. The Buffalo Bills are unionized, and so are the actors in Geva Theater, members of Actors Equity. So the union movement has, like the workforce, shifted toward public employment, toward white-collar work, toward professional work, as manufacturing, which used to dominate the union movement, has gone offshore and disappeared. Rochester is no exception to that. The loss of the manufacturing jobs here and a shift to the service sector is the principal underlying cause of poverty in this community, which to us in the labor movement is the number one issue. Earlier this year, in the wake of the Rochester Poverty Study, Professor Peter Edelman addressed a crowd of 500 at the Hyatt on the question of Rochester poverty. And Edelman said that there were seven major factors in poverty, but the absolute number one was low wages. We've become a low-wage nation. Over half of full-time jobs in the United States and in Rochester make less than $35,000 a year. That is not enough to be self-sufficient in the city of Rochester, let alone its suburbs. That is the number one problem facing working families. We need to organize against that, and we need to reach beyond our membership ranks and move to the public and the rest of the workers who are not in unions and help them solve that problem with us.
Okay. Before we move into some of these other issues, he mentioned poverty, Bruce did, and we're going to talk more about poverty in our community. We're going to talk about women in labor and CLUE, which is just over a year old in our community. Let me get our first call in because Gary wanted to jump in with a question about teachers. So go ahead, Gary.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Go ahead, Gary.
My question is, do we find that tenure plays a factor or is a role in keeping bad teachers that, like in every profession, we have a certain element that are bad, and it's hard to remove them after they receive tenure? So once you receive that tenure, you become lackadaisical in your teaching and your method and your trying to reach students. And we all know that there's the poverty factor and that there are elements that keep our children or restrict our children from learning. We are all sitting at the table as equal players. And we believe, some parents, including myself, that tenure causes a big problem in eradicating some of the problems that are across the board with our educational process. And thank you, and everyone have a good afternoon.
Thank you, Gary. Thanks for the phone call. Well, let's start with Shelley Clements, who's a labor relations specialist with NYSET. Go ahead.
Thank you for asking that question. A lot of people don't really understand exactly the nature of tenure. Tenure is a safeguard that ensures that good teachers can speak up for what students need. It was enacted, it's part of state law, and it was meant to be a safeguard to protect teachers from unfair firing. It's a basic due process right. It does not make it impossible for a teacher to lose their job. There are many steps that need to be taken before any member of a teaching staff can attain tenure, levels of observations, evaluations. They have to the district has to make sure, and they have 4 years now to make sure that the teacher is and has what they need in order to be successful in a classroom. Once they attain tenure, teachers still work to be their very best teacher. And if they're not, there's a process in place that is used in order to remove a teacher. The idea that a tenured teacher cannot be removed is an inaccurate a view of understanding of what tenure is.
On those lines, Rich in Rochester called in to respond to that. Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, I find that this attack on tenure is, I wonder if it's projection, because people assume that because you have a job, you're pretty secure in your job, you somehow, that automatically makes you lazy. I want to ask each one of these people who talk about tenure, if they had a job and they felt secure in it, would they just become lazy, or would they have a level of self-integrity? They talk about these teachers as if they're immoral people who care about nothing. And I find that pretty insulting to another individual that you don't even know. These are some really insidious assumptions being made about this group of people as people themselves. And I find this to be really troubling.
Rich, thank you for the phone call. What do you think, Shelley?
I don't disagree. If a person knows or loves a teacher, then they know better than anyone the amount of work and the amount of energy and the amount of effort that goes into making sure that you're the best person that you can be. Again, the job is easily one of the most important jobs that a person can have to educate the future of our nation.
You know very well, Shelley, that if I wanted to make this entire hour about tenure, we could do that. And this is not a dodge or a cop-out on the host part, because this is not an hour just about tenure. It came up in a conversation with a caller. It's fine. It's certainly and so let me at least just ask you this, Shelley.
Yes.
Has tenure become less of an issue in your actual day-to-day work, or is it just as supercharged as it's always been?
It's become a little bit more of an issue because of the attack by the governor and his efforts to increase tenure. He almost validated the misperceptions, the misconceptions that people have about what tenure is.
Yeah, and the governor has said he thinks it should be a priority to get rid of bad teachers. He said last year, earlier this year, I believe, in the winter into spring, when the budget was going on, when a lot of the legislative session was heated up, he thinks that teachers, bad teachers, can't be removed easily enough. I know you've heard that. Is there still a big disconnect with the governor on that?
Absolutely, still a big disconnect. And it all leads again back to the misunderstanding about what tenure is. Their due process rights. If you want to remove someone, as in most jobs, if you want to remove someone, you have to prove that they did something wrong.
All right, listeners, if you want to respond to that, you can. If you want to ask other questions or comments about the state of labor, we've got a lot to hit this hour with our guests. You're just hearing from Shelley Clements there, who's a labor relations specialist with NYSET, and she's with the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. And Bruce Popper's here, who's the president of the Rochester Labor Council. And Kendall Bell is the president of CLU, the Coalition of Labor Union Women, which is just over a year old now, Kendall, is that right?
That's right.
Okay, what's the mission of CLU?
The mission of CLU is to pretty much.
It's all right.
She lost my place in my notes here.
She's doing what the host does a lot, which is moving through a big pile of notes, and I've done that many times and lost my place many times. Go ahead.
CLU pretty much works to promote affirmative action in the workplace and strengthen the role of women in unions, also to help organize unorganized women and increase the involvement of women in the political and legislative processes.
So women working where? Who are the type of people who are involved with CLU?
They work in all different kinds of jobs. And we have public sector workers, such as myself, people in private sector. You have healthcare workers. It can run the gamut. You have people, women in non-traditional jobs. We have members from UAW, United Auto Workers. So, I mean, you can have a member of CLU from anywhere.
And how many local members do you have? How are you doing so far with it?
Right now, we have a little over 30 members. Mm-hmm. It took about 25 to get us our charter.
Which you got earlier this year, right?
We did in April of this year.
Okay. And so now the goal is what? What's the overall goal in Rochester? What's realistic for membership for you?
Well, our goal is to continually increase the membership. It can fluctuate. So, We look to maintain our 30 and also, I mean, help have people become interested in CLU and want to work with us to promote our mission. You know, and CLU it's primarily for women in labor. However, we work to advance the cause of women everywhere.
Okay. And before the hour began, we talked a little bit about what has been on CLU's radar, reproductive rights. Mm-hmm. And health care issues for women have been big in recent months for you?
Yes.
What's the state of that right now?
Well, right now there's an initiative within CLU to promote women's heart health. And they have partnered with an organization, with a health care organization that has developed some testing around coronary artery disease, which is the number one killer of women. And this particular test that they've developed is actually a test that works to identify genetically whether or not you're predisposed to coronary artery disease.
Okay. Similar to what Shelley said about teachers feeling under attack at times, mm-hmm. Are you concerned, is your organization concerned that reproductive rights have been under attack?
Absolutely. And we see that in decisions such as Hobby Lobby, which I'm sure people are familiar with, where an employer is able to pretty much refuse to help a woman with her reproductive health care because it's against their religious beliefs. You know, there are other avenues, but, I mean, why wouldn't your employer be obligated to provide health care, period?
Bruce, how often are you hearing about that as an issue here and nationally?
Well, certainly it's come to the forefront with the attack on Planned Parenthood of late, and it's certainly an important issue for not only women but men as well. The entire labor movement is concerned about this.
Bruce just said two words that could also weigh down the entire hour if we wanted to: Planned Parenthood. That's not the intention, and some would have a different characterization of Bruce. You're saying an attack on Planned Parenthood. Some others might characterize it differently. We'll probably talk about that on another day. But is this a bridge too far? It just feels so polarized right now. And I guess there's always going to be some polarization, Bruce, but does it feel like there's a wider gap on this issue than there's been in a long time? On reproductive rights, on what the responsibility is?
I think it goes in cycles. And I also think that it receives an amount of attention that tends to take us off of some basic economic disparities, which are also at the heart of unequal access to reproductive rights. And I return to the question of poverty and income disparity, because that affects access to health care. It affects access to reproductive rights coverage, good health care. We have many workers who are making too much, or their employer is qualifying to not be penalized under the Affordable Care Act, but yet the insurance that's offered is too expensive for low-wage workers. But since their employer is offering the insurance, they can't get on the exchanges for the Affordable Care Act's discounted insurance. That is another aspect directly related to health care. And what Kendall's talking about in terms of CLU intervening in an area of need that's not being fulfilled by our system. And disproportionately, we are finding access to reproductive rights, to health care in general for women, to be determined by their status of income. And poverty, again, becomes a major factor there.
You agree with that, Kendall?
I do.
Yeah,
I do.
If you want to join the program, you can call 844-295-TALK, toll-free 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Brad writes and says, I'm a teacher, get a little tired of everyone I know asking me about tenure. I didn't ask for it, but it is totally misunderstood. But Tim writes to us and says, I'm a union member in the electrical trade, and every one of my members think tenure gives the unions a bad name. He said it's a joke. He says, I know teaching is important, but he says, I'm tired of hearing that it's more important than my job or many other jobs. I'm an electrician. Is it more important, Shelley Clements? Do you think teaching is more important?
Well, I was trained as a teacher and came up in a classroom working with young people. So personally, yes, I do believe that. But that's my own personal opinion. It is an important trade, as are many other trades. It depends on what it is that you're trying to accomplish, on what's more important at any point in time.
Okay. Let me get back to the phones in just a second here. You can find us at Evan Dawson on Twitter as well. And let me get down to Geneseo, and this is Tim. Go ahead, Tim.
Hey, Evan. Enjoy your program. I wanted to offer a little bit of a take from an administration standpoint. I have been a teacher and a principal and now a superintendent. And, you know, there's a couple things about tenure that I think are important for people to know. One is, generally speaking, teachers who get tenure don't typically – I'm sorry, good teachers who get tenure – don't typically turn into lousy teachers later on in their careers. And so the downfall oftentimes of tenure is that the wrong people get tenure. Teachers who have not reached a level where their teaching really is effective or distinguished. And that really needs to be the standard for someone to earn tenure. The other thing is that what a lot of people don't understand is Civil service has rights that are very similar to tenure. You know, when we talk about Section 75 rights, and in my experience, you know, there are equal protections for people in the civil service branches that often don't get talked about, you know, with the same degree of passion that people seem to have about teacher tenure and principal tenure as well, administrator tenure as well.
Tim, before I let the panel respond, I just want to ask you, you said you're an administrator in Geneseo, is that right?
I am. I'm the superintendent of schools in Geneseo.
Well, thanks for calling. And
absolutely.
Your colleague in Fairport, well, actually, I think Bill Calla, your past colleague in Fairport, Dr. Calla was on this program earlier this year. He said that districts tend to do a much better job of vetting teachers and deciding who gets tenure or not, and that he thinks there's a misperception that mediocre teachers get tenure. He thinks it is much tougher to get tenure than is generally perceived. You're giving us a bit of a different picture.
I agree. I think that the job of administrators is to make sure that the right people get tenure. And when that happens, there tends to be much fewer problems down the line. And so I think, you know, if there's a weakness in the system, it's that in some districts, that, you know, the tenure process is not rigorous enough.
Okay. Stay on the line with us, Tim. I want to start with Shelley Clemens. What do you make of that, Shelley?
I would agree on many of the points. The one thing that I would add is that I don't believe that tenure is the problem. I believe that the perception of tenure is what is really the problem. The system works. People don't believe that, or people believe that it is something that it is not.
You said earlier, Shelley, that it is not as difficult as some would have you believe to remove a bad teacher. I want to know what Tim in Geneseo, again, the superintendent of Geneseo Schools, Tim, if you have to remove a bad teacher, a so-called bad teacher, and I know that's kind of a nebulous term, is the process onerous? Can it be done?
The process has a lot of requirements, but I will say the new expedited process is expedited. And so the changes that were made, I think it was a couple of years ago now, have made the process more streamlined and less expensive.
Yeah, that's exactly what we heard from NYSED earlier this year, that should be the case. And Tim is saying that does seem to be the case. Bruce Popper, you want to weigh in?
Well, Tim raises an important point that there are other protections that are similar to tenure that are not at the forefront of this controversy. The difference between being a union member covered by a contract and not being a union member as an employee is due process, the concept that Shelley raised. If you're covered by a union contract, the discipline clause says that you may be disciplined, including fired, but only for a just cause, which is a legal term that gives a person due process and the right to a hearing. That's guaranteed in almost every union contract that you see, and that is very different from the employment at will, which is the standard in New York State. We are an at-will state, which means that a non-union employee, a person not covered by an employment contract, can be fired at will for any reason, so long as it does not violate one of the discrimination laws. So literally, you can be fired for the color of your socks, and you have no recourse unless you're covered by a contract or, as Tim's pointed out, by a civil service law if you are a civil servant. And that really is a very, very important concept. Tenure was enacted, as Shelley said, to protect the rights of teachers in defense of education. Mm-hmm. I've represented a lot of registered nurses in my career, and it is a very vital, their contract protection for due process is an extremely vital element for registered nurses to be able to speak up when they see problems in a hospital or a healthcare setting in defense of their patients. They get that through a union contract, teachers get it through tenure and their contracts, civil servants get it through other means, but these are all vital elements for people to be able to do a quality job and to serve the public.
Tim, any disagreement there with what Bruce just said?
I'm sorry, Evan, were you talking to me?
Yeah, any disagreement with what you just heard from Bruce?
No, I mean, the bottom line with tenure is it is supposed to give tenured teachers due process in terms of discipline. You know, you can't, 3020A is required to discipline a tenured teacher. And that was the intent of the law. And, you know, that's how it works.
Tim, when you hang up with me, send me an email separately, Wade, because I know it's always good for me to kind of talk to a wide range of people and administrators, and it's our first conversation. So send me a note, and we'll chat a little bit more offline if we could.
I sure will, Evan.
Thanks very much. That's Tim in Geneseo, who's a superintendent there. Anyone can email me. I always love hearing from listeners. It's edawson@wxxi.org. I'm on Twitter at Evan Dawson. And we're going to get back to the phones in just a second. We're going to talk in our second half hour about a number of other issues. You might have heard about the fight for 15. We'll talk about that. And we're talking labor issues in general. Your phone calls, welcome. Bruce Popper, it's a big weekend for labor. Labor Day weekend coming up. You've got a parade. You've got the Labor Day film series coming up. Give us a sense for what you want our audience to know about what's coming up here.
Well, we're in our either 26th or 27th year of a labor film series. It takes place at the George Eastman House on East Avenue. It kicks off this Friday evening at 8 p.m. in the Dryden Theater of the George Eastman House with a film called The Hand That Feeds. And it's about immigrant fast food workers in New York City who are exploited in their wages and their working conditions and decide to organize. And it's a compelling tale that took place. It's a documentary. It took place a few years ago. And it came in the wake of Occupy Wall Street in the east side of Manhattan. We will be having a post-film discussion for those that wish to hang around. And my understanding is we will have some of the activists from the Fight for 15 to come and talk about their struggle in the fast food industry.
Okay. So that's what's coming up. And the parade details, people have been asking, so one more time, parade details coming up, Bruce?
We're back on Monday, Labor Day. We took a brief change last year to coincide with the National Drum and Bugle Corps convention here. We're back on Monday, that's September 7th. Parade kicks off at 11 a.m. We'll come East Avenue to Main Street, a slightly different route because of the construction with the filling in of the inner loop over at East Avenue side. But it will go down Main Street, and the reviewing stand will be in its usual place on West Main Street. So we welcome everybody to come down and see the union movement and our friends and allies on parade. There will be community groups there as well who parade with us and celebrate Labor Day by coming downtown for a good parade and some music.
All right, short break, and we're coming back with a conversation on issues related to labor in 2015, including the fight for 15. Maybe we'll ask the panel what they think of. You might have seen the AFL-CIO was a little critical of Hillary Clinton. He says she's got to do more to fire up labor before the election, before she gets the support of labor. We'll talk a little bit about that. Your phone calls as well with our guest, Bruce Popper, who's the president of the Rochester Labor Council. Kendall Bell, who's the president of CLUW, C-L-U-W. That's the Coalition of Labor Union Women. And Shelley Clements, who's here not only with NYSET, but also the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists as well. That's coming up next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on the next Connections. An alarming number of American children are obese, but it turns out a lot of parents have a hard time coming to grips with that fact. They don't like admitting it. We're looking at a new local program designed to help eliminate childhood obesity. Then, second hour, we're talking about black holes. What did Stephen Hawking say? Brian Koberline of RIT explains. Talk to you Thursday.
There was a party in a Baltimore women's wear shop last weekend. The store celebrated its reopening 4 months after being damaged in the riot that followed the death of Freddie Gray.
It's really encouraging that somebody stuck through all the adversity and is back here.
Bringing businesses back to Baltimore later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and Shelley Clements, you're never going to guess what our next caller wants to talk about.
Oh, could it be? Maybe tenure.
I think John in Rochester wants to talk tenure. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Hey, panel.
Hi,
you
there.
Know,
hello.
I have to say, I was watching a documentary last night on Andrew Carnegie and how much of a bad guy he was to the working person. And because of Andrew Carnegie and some others, of course, Andrew Carnegie and Rockefeller or whatever were fundamentally put us on the map as far as industrializing the United States. But on the other side of it, they were very cruel to the workers, and the unions came out of it, which was a good thing. But I think we're at a point now where we've got so many local, state, and federal labor laws, unions really aren't that important. In fact, I would make the case they are hurting us. especially in the public sector. FDR actually didn't think public sector unions were needed and shouldn't be needed because they would it would be too much of a hindrance between the public and the unions who were serving the public servants are serving the taxpayers. So my point is this. I think especially in the public sector, if you look at New York State, one of our big problems in New York State are the public unions. They have too much clout over the government, and our taxation is out the roof. And ironically, the people that are paying for this, a majority of people, even in New York State, are non-unionized, and this tax burden's on the back of the working people. I think Scott Walker has the right idea. I think right-to-work states are the key to economic vitality in the United States. What are your thoughts?
John, thank you for the phone call. That was beyond tenure. So at least, Shelley, we get to go beyond tenure now. Yeah. I appreciate the phone call, John. I'm going to start with Bruce Popper. Bruce?
Well, first of all, right-to-work states are states that ban union contracts that require people to pay equal fees for the services. Those states that are right-to-work states are the states with the lowest wages, the lowest standard of living, the worst social services, and the worst safety net for their populations. The problem with our standard of living is, in fact, the decline of unionization in the private sector. As manufacturing, a relatively heavily unionized sector, declined in this country and in this community, it was not replaced with a new wave of unionization in the service industry, healthcare, retail, social services, hotel and hospitality. These are all low-wage venues except for the top professionals in those areas. There is some degree of middle-class employment if you can work your way up the career ladder in healthcare, but otherwise these are all low-wage jobs in our community. We've been here before in American history, and it was the 1930s. When manufacturing jobs, transportation jobs, most of the jobs in the private sector were in fact very low-wage jobs. And those workers unionized, raised the standard of living, made a standard for health care being linked to health insurance, employment with health insurance. It was the invention of pensions. And with the union movement's political lobbying, the invention of Social Security, minimum wage laws. The laws on the books that protect workers are very minimal. It's minimum wage, some health and safety standards, not a whole lot else. And if you ever try to pursue cases on behalf of non-union workers, it is a nightmare of bureaucracy, delay, and often frustration on the part of workers trying to pursue those rights, especially if they don't have an advocate.
Shelley, Kendall, you want to weigh in on that?
I would offer that in New York State, particularly, unions are the essential force providing a counterweight to bad public policy, to worker exploitation, to corporate greed, to unsafe working conditions. And in my field, in overtesting and other violations of sound, best educational practice. So the need for unions is very real. The laws do not provide the protections.
In other words, they're disagreeing with John's characterization that John would might say, well, you talk about the 1930s, Bruce, but that was a different time, fewer laws, fewer legal protections, and the difference now is those are baked into our legal system so much more now. You're saying not the case. Shelley, you're saying?
They're really minimal protections. Okay. When you go look at what they are in terms of minimum wage, some of the discrimination laws, we need to have them on the books as a floor, but the floor is awfully low.
Okay, Kendall, any thoughts there?
Well, I think that people need to remember that even though it's public sector, we're talking an employer. So even though it's government work, we're treated the same way that anyone else would be in private sector. It's just that someone's whim is not able to govern how we're dealt with as far as disciplinary measures and things like that.
Here's a different John in Rochester who emailed the program. Excuse me. He says, regarding labor and due process, he says, your guests talk about due process, but employment is not a court of law. It is, or should be, a consensual agreement between employer and employee. We in the private sector are not fired willy-nilly without reason. Tenure, work rules, and so on make employment adversarial when everyone should be on the same team to accomplish an organization's goals. Panels, thoughts on that? Bruce?
I don't know what the emailer's job background has been, but it is certainly an uneven playing field when individual employees try to solve problems or enforce their rights with employers, particularly if they work for a larger employer or larger company.
He's implying it's not as adversarial when there's not a union involved.
Well, subservience may not look as adversarial, but I would say to you that the unequal power of individual workers versus their employers is quite stark. And unions are the counterbalance to that power. And it's actually enshrined in the preface to the National Labor Relations Act about the unequal power between workers and corporations in this country, and that the National Labor Relations Act, passed, yes, in the 1930s during the Roosevelt administration, was designed to correct that imbalance. And we are back in a period of massive inequality, inequality in income, in access to health care, in retirement security, and in job security, like we've never known in my lifetime. And again, I go back to the solution is workers organizing in different forms. It may be not conventional unions, like the Fight for 15 is a very broad-based movement. We have a workers' center in town now called POWER, People Organizing Workers for Empowerment and Respect, where non-union workers, low-wage workers, can go for assistance on their rights and also training and advocacy. These are approaches that are absolutely essential right now if we're to restore some balance in employment versus corporate power.
Well, Bruce just mentioned the Fight for 15, and that's something that our listeners might have been following throughout the year. The Fight for 15 referring to a $15 minimum wage in this state for the fast food industry. In other places, there's been talk about a $15 minimum wage, period, across the board. We did see the governor's wage board make the recommendation that New York State fast food workers be set a floor of $15 as a minimum wage, and we're on our way to doing that. But Bruce, let me follow that up with this. NPR just had a story yesterday called The Restaurant with No Visible Workers. And here's their opening. Sometimes fast food just isn't fast enough. A new highly automated restaurant that opened in San Francisco on Monday looks to speed service through efficiency. It could be the latest sign that the industry is heading toward a more robotic future, a move some analysts say will be accelerated by the push to boost the minimum wage that so many fast food workers are relying on. Are we automating the fast food industry when we push for higher wages?
No, the industry is going to automate. If it means profit, the industry will automate as fast as possible anyways. That's the nature of competition.
You don't think faster if we go to $15 an hour?
I doubt it. I doubt it. I would also say that the movement for $15 started with fast food. It has spread to many other places. My members at the University of Rochester reached an agreement last year with the university. It wasn't adversarial. We both agreed that experienced workers, service workers at the University of Rochester, who have been there at least 5 years, will make a minimum of $15 an hour during this contract. And the university management saw that in their interest to stabilize the workforce, to be competitively selective with who they hire. Those workers also have a very good health plan with no copayment of premium. We have a child care fund there, funded by the employer. We also have training and educational benefits, which our members, at any given time, 10% of my membership at the University of Rochester is in some form of continuing education, be that English as a second language, GED, right up to master's degrees. And that's all paid for through funds there. So the benefit package and a minimum of 15 makes the University of Rochester have a quality workforce, which is stable, does a good job, and has the security that we need to provide the best possible services to our public.
Before we get back to the phones, Rocco and Gary will be coming to you as we continue our discussion with local labor leaders about the state of labor 2015. Let me ask our panel about what some folks have been saying about the national scene, and I'm curious how they weigh in. And here's the article that I just read yesterday about AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka. And here it is. He says, while Clinton is an experienced candidate, she, quote, has to really figure out a way to energize workers by showcasing pro-labor policies that she's willing to fight for. That's what Trumka told reporters at a Christian Science Monitor breakfast. He also warned that without a clear message, quote, Hillary Clinton could catch some fire from pro-labor groups. He cited her ambiguity in the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade deal, as an example of an issue that lessens the energy that unions derive from her. And he said the AFL-CIO strongly opposes the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is still in negotiations. And there's a bit of a flirtation with Bernie Sanders. Let's go around the table here. Kendall Bell, I'll start with you. Have you made up your mind yet? And, you know, John Kasich on the Republican side said he's getting friendlier with labor. You know, has labor made up any sort of decision on where you want to see it go next year?
Well, I can't say for sure. But I know that there, whoever we do endorse has to have a very, very strong backing for helping us keep our jobs, helping keep jobs here in the United States, which is one of the reasons we're very much against the TPP, because that's all of our jobs going away. And then what are we supposed to do? People want to talk about us being, or labor being negative for the for everyone all around. But if you take away the jobs, if you take away our ability to earn a living for anyone, then where does that leave us? You know, we definitely need to have a candidate who is going to back us and make sure that we have jobs to take care of our families with and to make America viable with.
Now, the president has said the TPP won't do what Kendall just said, and Hillary Clinton will see what she says. Is Hillary Clinton doing enough to earn your vote right now?
Right now, I'm going to sit back and see what she comes forth with.
Okay, Shelley Clements? Yeah.
Well, I'm going to put on my Coalition of Black Trade Unionists hat right now and say that CBTU has leveraged our resources in all of the different unions to mobilize black voters to influence elections and public policy at every level. And once a decision is made about who is going to be the candidate, we will make sure that we get our members to the polls so that they can cast their ballots for.
How are you going to do that?
Oh, every year our local chapter provides rides to voters to the polls, to their polls, to get them to make that choice.
And Shelley, does it start with getting them registered? Is it registration first?
Absolutely. We do registration. We hold registration events. Most of the coalition groups do hold registration events for members throughout the city, throughout the region. And then from there, we make sure that folks in the city know exactly how to get in contact with us, and we help them get to their polling place, encouraging people to exercise their rights to vote for whomever seems to be the best candidate.
And Shelley, I'm probably part of the media problem on this. We fixate on the big elections, the presidential elections, but we know that our communities are built at times by small elections, but I would say small elections, city council, county legislature. You know, your local town races, those are important. Are they important to the Council of Black Trade Unionists?
They are. They are. What our elected officials do is set public policy that affects how we move and exist in our communities. So local is almost at times more important than your national elections.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a metric of success on this? I mean, you want what percentage of your members to vote? You know, what's realistic for you?
Well, we would want all CBTU members to vote. That's our expectation. But additionally, in terms of moving bodies to the polls, as large a group, as large a percentage as possible, that's what we're going for. We work nonstop during on election day, during the day, to move as many bodies as we can to the polls.
All right, Bruce Popper, the president of the Rochester Labor Council. AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka says Hillary Clinton has got to do a lot more to get labor energized before she can count on their votes. Where are you on this?
I think we're pretty early in the game. We're about issues, not personalities. So union members will back candidates who also back their rights and who have a perspective that this society is heading in the wrong direction when it comes to its economy and its working families. We need to reverse the trend on wages. We need to even increase access to health care. The attempts to overturn the Affordable Care Act we think are unfortunate and misdirected. And we need to back candidates who back working people's right to survive and prosper. And those issues determine who we back at the national level, the state level, and the local level. We have a very participatory interview process, both at the Labor Council and in many of the locals, where our members interview candidates. It's good education on both sides. It educates candidates about what working people are challenged by, and it also educates our members who become active in what the political stakes are in our community. So it really is about those issues, and on the presidential, there'll be a lengthy process. We are in the process in my local 1199 SEIU of doing a very intensive survey process on the presidential elections, which is all issues driven. There's no candidate names, but it says what are the most important things. We've computerized our returns on that, so there's been mailings, there's been emails, and there's been hand-to-hand distribution and collection in our major employment areas. So we're actually surveying our members through these different means about what's important to them, and then we'll make a judgment in the labor movement as to who best fits those criteria.
In Farmington, this is Rocco. Go ahead, Rocco.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Sure. I just have a quick comment. I have been in the construction business for about 30 years, and mostly around union employees. But lately, I noticed that the average person, the average worker that is non-union wants nothing to do with a union. Now, I've tried to figure this out, and I can't. And I realize that, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, roughly 15% of all workers are unionized, give or take. I know I'm not right on the money with that number. But when you talk to people and ask them, well, why wouldn't you want to make more money or have better benefits, and the answers are pretty ludicrous. I just want to leave it there, and if you guys could ponder that for a second, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Rocco. Thoughts from the panel?
Boy, if thanks, Rocco. If we could solve that problem, it's at the heart of what we're trying to figure out. Is it low expectations? Is it you can't fight the system? I mean, you know, the statistics are pretty compelling. I mean, union members make more for the same types of jobs. They have better health care. Many of them have retirement security and pensions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There is fierce employer resistance and a very well-organized propaganda system against unions, blames unions as if they're some third party as opposed to organizations of workers that are run democratically by the workers. If we were able somehow to educate and communicate more folks about that, but Rocco, what Rocco's raised is at the heart of what we are trying to solve in terms of public perception, because the results of unionization are very clear, as he put forth. It's more money on the job, it's more job security, and it's better health care.
I think, too, at least for me, I've been a union member since I was 16 years old. I was in UFCW at Star Supermarkets when I was a 16-year-old. But I always saw the union as being a voice, a place where I could have a voice in my working conditions and in safety on the job and what the standards are going to be and how things should operate or could operate to be better in my working situation. So I've never really understood how someone would not want to join together and to have a voice and to be that change in your workplace.
Let me grab Gary, and Gary, let's keep it tight. Go ahead, Gary.
Okay, thanks, Evan. The reason I called today is, I think you know this, that for a few years I worked as a constitutional rights / civil rights advocate and representative, and a couple of the calls and comments that you got indicate to me that people seem to think that if they do a good job and they're competent, they can't be fired. And I can't tell you the number of phone calls and referrals I used to get from people that would say, particularly in the retail industry where there are no unions, that they would walk into work one day and the boss would say, oh, yeah, by the way, you're fired. Because there was a shortage in the till, and even though you weren't working, we're just going to fire everybody, and that way we don't have to worry about trying to figure out who it was. New York is what's referred to as an at-will state. And people were often shocked that when I would explain this to them, that, look it, in New York, your boss can walk in and just say, you know what, I don't like you, you're fired. And there just seems to be this misconception that you're safe in your job, and unless you do something wrong, and that is just not the case. So I just wanted to make sure that was cleared up, that New York is an at-will state, and unless it's for some reason of discrimination, your boss can just fire you anytime they please. Thanks.
Gary, thank you for the phone call. Before we lose the hour, and Bruce Popper and our panel, by the way, Kendall and Shelley, were nodding along with you, Gary. But before we lose the hour, Bruce, remind our listeners, you've got a parade and a film festival coming up. What's coming up?
Friday, September 4, George Eastman House, Dryden Theater, the opening of the Labor Film Series with the movie The Hand That Feeds, with a post-film discussion involving the fast food workers. Monday, Labor Day, September 7, 11 a.m. kickoff, downtown Rochester for the Labor Day Parade. Come down and celebrate the contributions of workers to our community with the thousands of members of our unions who will be marching with the bands and vehicles and balloons and our community friends.
And what time on Monday?
11 a.m.
11 a.m. Thank you, Bruce. Bruce Popper is the president of the Rochester Labor Council. Thank you very much for being here, Bruce. Shelley Clements, a labor relations specialist with NYSET and with the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. Shelley, nice to have you here.
Thank you.
And Kendall Bell, who is a member of the Federation of Social Workers and president of CLUW, C-L-U-W, that's Coalition of Labor Union Women. Thank you, Kendall.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for listening. Thanks for all the feedback this afternoon here on Member Supported Public Radio. Thanks to Val LaBanca, our outstanding engineer, and to Barsook Records for providing the music for this program. I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Member Supported Public Radio.